you know, making movies is hard.
Making movies is hard.
Welcome. This is the podcast about the struggle of being an independent filmmaker. I'm Mark Purcell, the founding host of the podcast, and I'm a sci-fi horror filmmaker, and my first feature film, The Alternate, is out now on digital, DVD, and Tubi, and my second script is done. Oh my God. I'm going to start working on the pre-production or pre-production soon.
And also your film is on Amazon Prime. I know that's encompassed in digital, but I always like to make sure you're pimped out, you know, to the nines.
Thank you.
I'm Liz Manischel. I'm a writer, director, producer who has directed two features, Bread and Butter and Speed of Life. And I'm currently in pre-production on my third, Best Friends Forever. I'm a producer's rep and I used to work at Sundance.
This week, we welcome director Stefan Bristol on the show to talk about his second feature film, Breathe, which he made with Thunder Road, which apparently is like the hip to the jam production company that everybody works with. He talks about being mentored by Spike Lee and how he got his first feature produced by Netflix. After that, we play another round of You're the Expert. But first, Liz, how are you doing today?
I'm doing all right. I got to go on a hike today. So it's mid-week hike, which are very unusual for me. And it always keeps my creative juices flowing. And I think probably worthy of mentioning is I'm noodling on a new idea. And it's a way to incorporate my family, hang out with them, while also doing previs for the next feature. So we'll see if I actually do this. I really hope I do. But my plan is to make my movie with my family as the cast, scene by scene or shot by shot, on like YouTube or Instagram or TikTok while I'm in pre-production and while I raise money. And it's just going to be like silly, like just fun and silly, but give me a chance to incorporate my kids in what I do and just play in a very safe place to start making this movie.
Nice. Do you think your kids are going to be receptive to know, doing this?
Yeah. I brought it up to Colin last night and I was like, you know, mama makes movies. Like, he gets it, but he doesn't get it. He's like, yeah. And I was like, well, I'm going to make a movie in probably a few months and I need to practice making this movie. Do you want to be an actor in it? And he's like, yeah. Like, he got so excited. And I was like, okay, not tonight, but maybe tomorrow we'll start. So after our Gabby Dollhouse scavenger hunt, maybe we'll do the first shot today.
Wow. I wish you luck. This is really cool. I love this idea. That's Thanks. Very inspiring.
Yeah.
Getting your family involved is really sweet.
Yeah. I just think I had this idea, which I was going to do like short, weird, abstract videos just to keep on making projects, just like weird, whatever, sketches, things. And then I thought, why am I creating a whole other project? Why shouldn't I do something where it actually contributes to the development, the creative development of what I'm most interested in doing, which is this big project, Best Friends Forever. So we'll see how long it lasts. And I'm going to keep it private until I aggregate enough videos. But the plan is, like, what if I can cut together like a little movie? Because of Matt Farley and because of another filmmaker I'm working with called, his name is Toby Jones. I'm really loving the embrace into amateur and authentic, that like weird valley of like amateur and authentic that happens in some things that we talk about, like Matt Farley and kind of non-actors, and I don't know, that like great awkwardness in that kind of art. So I kind of wanted to experiment and dabble in that.
Nice.
What's going on for you?
Well, yeah, as I mentioned at the top of the show, the script is done.
Yes.
Which is amazing. And I have been sending it to people. So a few people have gotten it so far, but I've gotten zero notes. And I realized that the deadline for Austin is Friday. So I'm more than likely not going to get notes in before Friday, and not going to have time to take anybody's feedback and incorporate it into the draft I submit. But I'm going to do another pass this week, you know, before Friday, and just like do another polished pass. And there's one small thing I want to add in one scene that I think I had meant to add before, and then I just didn't. So yeah, just like one little thing that will help tie in something later. And it might be cut, but it's just a little, I think it will help the reader, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, so that's the main thing that's going on. Yeah, I mean, I read a couple scripts recently, one for a woman, Sarah, who's a listener of the show, this short that she's trying to do. It's like a proof of concept for a feature. And so I read that. I read a couple drafts of that, actually. And then I'm reading my friend Rob Ryuta's short script right now too. And so I'm basically reading all this stuff to like, be like, okay, now it's time to, you know, ask people to read my own work, you know, like a little trade. Let's see. Oh, I sent off my, my final, this is really boring, but I think like people will find it interesting. I sent out the final K-1s for the alternate.
Oh yeah.
We're going to dissolve the LLC, or we already did, just because we don't really need it anymore. And you know, I don't want to spend whatever it is. It's like
$800 a year,
800 plus tax fees. So it's something like, yeah, I don't know, $1,200 a year that I have to just spend out of my own pocket that I'll never get back. So I just, you did that. And I sent a message to all my investors with their final K-1 and a thank you and another thank you after many thank yous. And then like kind of a breakdown of where the movie's at and everything. And I got some really good, and then I was like, and making my next one. So if you're interested, let me know. And then like two or three people said they were, and they want to like talk about it. So like, I'm like, oh, sweet. So I've got at least two who are going to chat with me, and maybe a third. So yeah, that was really encouraging that like, even after like the movie, you know, headline is not going to make its money back, that they still want to hear about what's happening next. I thought that was a really encouraging sign that I wasn't necessarily expecting, you know? So yeah, so getting the ball moving. I mean, I can't say that I'm like in the stages of even pre-production, but like I'm basically not even financing, like basic, very, very beginning, like just starting to like, I don't know. I mean, I think I will send it to a couple of people who would be potential investors in this state. I might wait one more draft, you know, just like get some initial feedback.
I haven't even read the script, but I think you should wait just a tiny little bit.
Yeah, don't jump the gun. I get so excited, but yeah, I think I should just, I'll just work a little bit more on it, get it a little bit better. But the problem is like some of these people who could be potential investors are also writers and also science fiction nuts. So it's like, it's kind of nice to get their input too, you know? So we'll see. We'll see who I end up sending it to.
I think the decision of when to send your script out more widely is an instinctual one. But like what you haven't even been through the process of like getting the bullshit notes back that you're going to bristle at, and then get the good notes back that you're going to integrate. Yeah. This is my process. It's like bullshit notes, good notes, and then something clicks into place where you're like, okay, I'm ready. Right. Like, have you had the click, or are you just hoping? You're just too excited.
I don't even know what anyone thinks of this thing. I know people might be like, this is insane, you know.
And who really cares, but it'll impact how you feel about it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I know Beth, my wife, read the, like, you know, the first 6 or 7 pages, and she had some feedback, but it was just basically based off of one character. And I was like, oh, well, you know, whatever. That's not a big deal. Like, I wanted her to get to the actual start of the movie. Yeah. And, you know, she hasn't gotten there yet. So it's like, all right, well, I'll save all feelings about her thoughts on it until she's done reading the script, you know?
Yeah.
But she did say she didn't want to stop reading, so that's good.
Oh.
So as long as you want to keep reading, I think you're doing pretty good. So yeah, I don't know. That's what's going on. I mean, yeah, just trying to figure out how to make this movie and like what the plan's going to be. I think that, and I have lots of ideas now about like reaching out to different people in Vallejo and trying to figure out some maybe cheap or very, very inexpensive, not free. It would be nice if it was free, but probably more in a very inexpensive warehouse space where we can, you know, set up for our sets. Cause like we probably have like at least 3 sets, maybe even more that we have to make for this movie. And so, yeah, it's a little bit different than my last movie. Well, I mean, we did have sets, but like these sets are a little more complicated than like, you know, a basement office. This is like spaceships and, you know, mad scientist labs and things like that. But yeah, you know, what's also really cool and fun to talk about is our Patreon page. Go to www.patreon.com/MMIHpodcast. That's the way that the show will go on and continue. Thank you all for the patrons who support the show. This is like how we pay our editor, Jeff, and how the show survives. We're trying to think of like what we can do special for our patrons. We haven't really figured that out yet because like we took away the paywall, which was like the big thing. We're going to come up with something special soon. So stay tuned and thank you for your support. Or not. Liz says not.
I don't know if I have a lot of faith in us to come up with anything anytime soon. But if someone were to suggest something, we really could we could make that happen. Like, I think I don't read the podcast inbox, but if there were recommendations or suggestions from listeners, like, we want to hear from you. So let us know if there's something you want or need.
Exactly. And then also don't forget to give us a review on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, as it's called now. That's super helpful. It's a really great way to like spread the show around, probably just as good as the Patreon. So, you know, give us a review if you have the time. But without any more delay, here is my and Eric's chat with Stefan Bristol. All right. Well, we're here today with Stefan Bristol, director of Breathe. Can you tell us the elevator pitch for Breathe?
The elevator pitch for Breathe would probably be like, you know, Breathe takes place in the future in a post-apocalyptic Brooklyn where the earth no longer have any oxygen. You got this family living in the bunker and must ward off these weirdos from Philadelphia that's trying to break into the bunker. So it's like Home Alone meets Children of Men.
Oh, wow. Oh, that's intense. About how many days did you shoot?
25, unfortunately.
Wow. Never enough time.
For a movie of this size, that's definitely pretty tight.
Not enough time. No, it's very tight. I won't recommend it.
If you can say, what was the rough budget of the film?
Around 15 mil.
Nice.
Great. And where was the origin of the idea? So I'm guessing you were looking around the world and it's on its way to a post-apocalyptic landscape and you're like, yeah, no, we can't breathe anymore.
No. The most ironic thing is this, right? I was just finishing the release of my first feature film, you know, which is months after, and I just needed to figure out my next film. And I was looking at The Blacklist, you know, that's, you know, The Blacklist had like different scripts that's going around, floating around Hollywood and people talking about it. And so if people talking about it and can't really find a way to make it home, they just put it on The Blacklist to see if anybody would, you know, the whole story of The Blacklist, right? So I saw it on the entire Blacklist that year. It was 2019, November 2019. The entire Blacklist that year, I was like, nah, this is corny. All of it was terrible, but except for Breathe. I saw the log line for Breathe. I said, that's very interesting. So I let my agent get me the script, and I read the script. I was like, I can do this, you know. But it was set place upstate New York on a farm. And I was like, nah, this got to be in Brooklyn. And also, the family going to be black. So, you know, so I had a meeting with Thunder Road about it, and they said, you know, we love your, you know, the change of the ethnicity and it being also the change of the background being in Brooklyn, but we need to elevate the script a little bit because right now the script was open for interpretation, right? There was another A-list director who I don't know who that was. There was another A-list director that wanted to make it like Mad Max and was pushing someone like Scarlett Johansson type of actress to play the lead role in it. And Thunder Road didn't want it to be a contained film because I love the script, really call it to be contained. I'd say that's the reason why I love that to be as well, you know. But we need to elevate the script a little bit, you know. And I was like, okay, great. So they're down for Brooklyn. They're down for the family to be, you know, to be African American. And this, and but what is, you know, what can we anchor the story around instead of just being like a thriller, right? And I was like, okay, let me just read the script. So I read the script like, you know, a couple of times. And what I noticed is that everybody was talking about their children. You know, Maya, the main character, was talking about her protecting her daughter. The two individuals from Philadelphia was talking about getting oxygen to bring back to their children in Philadelphia. And I said, that is what the movie's about. It's really about creating a different world and different space for the next generation because we're leaving our current planet to shit for our next generation. And my agent during that time was like, yo, this reminds me of a Native American proverb that goes something like, we don't inherit the earth from our ancestors, we borrowed it from our children. So we kind of, you know, created the script around the protection of Zora. And, you know, it's Zora is the one that gets tied up and we got to make sure she's okay. And so, you know, we kind of anchored that theme through the protection of Zora. So that's the, you know, that's the entire genesis. But the funny thing is when I signed the deal for it, right? When I signed the deal for the movie, 3 days later, the World Health Organization declared a pandemic planet. And then me, the producers and the writer, Doug Simon, we were all look at each other like, yo, now this is a pandemic. You know, so while we was doing the rewrites, right, we kind of like... you know, a lot of things on our real time experience with the pandemic into the script. So it was kind of weird that way.
That's awesome. So how long did you spend working on the film from like when you found it on the Blacklist to it now being released?
3 years. Hmm. Now being three, yeah, about 3 years. because 2019 to that, like beginning of 2020, signed the film, and then, you know, we was trying to find the actress to put a lead role, and, you know, different actresses were turning it down. So we landed on Jennifer Hudson. You know, not to say, you know, anything, you know, I'm so grateful they got Jennifer Hudson, because when somebody, when an actor, when a producer told me, what you think of Jennifer Hudson? At first I was, you know, I was a bit on the fence, but then I think about it a little bit longer, and I imagine Jennifer Hudson holding a shotgun. I thought, this is going to be wild, man. It's like, yeah, you want to do this, baby. Yay! You know, so it's, so it's, it was about, it took us a little while just to find the financing, because we had to get, we had to finish the script first. It took us about 6 months to like really get the script to where it needs to be, and then we got to lock in the actors, and that took a little bit longer as well, because, you know, no actor right now likes to be attached to a movie, right, for the sake of trying to find financing. Mm-hmm. Because what happened, because, you know, the word gets around, like, why did this studio didn't pick this movie up? Why? It's exposed the actor a little bit. But unfortunately, that's the way of the game in the film industry, especially trying to do studio or really high-end independent filmmaking. You want to attach actors first and then find financing, because it brings value to the project along with it. So, it's, and, you know, I being, this is my second feature film, nobody's going to finance a movie just because, but just off of me. I'm, you know, I'm still relatively new and green in the film industry, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Not to say I don't have the chops to pull movies like this off. It's just, you know, I'm just not proven yet. So, you know, I was blessed enough for Mila, Sam Worthington, Common, and Jennifer to attach, because they saw a promise in me, because my last film, See Yesterday, you know, they really loved it. They know I work with Spike Lee, so anybody, you know, I have experience with a mentorship. And plus, you know, great producers, Basil Iwanek and Erica Lee, Thunder Road has already have accolades already in history. So, you know, it was somewhat of an uphill climb to get the actors and the financing, because it's almost the same way, you know, I did See You Yesterday. It's making sure I'm surrounded by experienced crew. That's mm-hmm. the trick. Is it with really, like, with really good cast, great cinematographer, who's a dear friend of mine from NYU, Felipe Verder Ray, very good friend of mine from NYU. I mean, of course, top-notch producers, you know, Basil, Erica, you know, they've done these movies thousands of times, and great production designer and whatnot, and on, you just surround a director with a lot more experienced people than him or her, and then the film will flourish.
Mm. Now, you're on the other side of it. You've finished. Congratulations. Now, if you could go back in time and change one thing, what would it be? This could be pre-production, this could be production, post, whatever it happened to be.
I'm talking about my career or the film.
Oh, for the film, for this film, for Breathe.
There was nothing in my control, man. It's not that I can change. And everything was literally out of my control. All I can do was do my best to prepare for the film and show up every day ready to go. You know, it's nothing mm-hmm. I can. Whatever's in my control, I did the best I could. I don't, you know, and I, from that experience, I've learned so much. And there's a lot of failures I made while making a film. I don't want to go back and change that, because I learned from those failures. You know what I'm saying? I don't, you know, that's anti-productive as an artist. The only way for me to grow is to continue to feel, be in pain from those failures and keep moving forward. So I'm not changing anything.
Right on.
Can you talk a little bit about, like, one example of what you would call a failure on your feature? Because obviously, like, we all know as filmmakers that we go through these things that, like, it's like, oh my God, I wish that had gone differently. I wish I had made this different decision or whatever. But it would be really great to hear, like, one of these things, if you're willing to share.
Yeah, we don't have to frame it as a failure, but more, it's like, when did you learn the hardest?
I learned the hardest when directing the actors, man. You know, you think, once again, I only come in with what I know, you know, from only my experience. I thought that I can direct every actor the same. Even though it's like, you know, I know you can't, every actor is different, but I coming in like trying to direct all the actors the same way. Like, I want you here, I want you this way. And like, it was very rigid. Mm-hmm. Every single scene, and it always bumped heads with the actors. You know what I'm saying? So like, you know, the term herding cats and whatnot. But it's like, it had to go through the experience of not, like learning, like, every actor needed somebody different. Like Jennifer, she wants to know she wants to be told every single detail of the scene, each scene, every single detail about the past, every single, like, she needed that. for her to flourish in the scene. Mila, not so much. She comes with you with her ideas, and then you listen, and then you, like, there's a dance to it. You know what I'm saying? Common had to stop me one time and say, yo, brother, just tell us how you see the scene, and let us find our way through it. Instead of being so, I want you to hear, I want you to there, because, like, even the scene right in the beginning of the film, right after the grandfather is killed. You know, I'm not giving away much. Like, you know, someone dies in the beginning of the movie. Everybody dies in the movie. So the beginning of the movie, like, this, there was the grandfather gets killed. He comes home and they all sit around the table. At first, I wanted Quvenzhané to sit on the ground and Thomas sit someone else. And, you know, but for them, this doesn't feel natural. And, you know, actors always want something to do in the scene, you know? So, like, I always have to give Quvenzhané something, because she said, I don't want to just stand around not doing anything to begin the scene. So it's like, I have to remember to get rid of my own, you know, ideas and vision of it, you know, all the time. Like, be very rigorous. Like, me and Felipe would sit down and do shots and everything. But sometimes, like, you know, they have to go out the window. Thankfully, you go into it prepared. You have to go into a shoot prepared, you know what I'm saying? But you have to always leave room for other people's interpretation, for your actor's interpretation, right? And you always have to leave room when, you know, your ideas don't go your way. At least you come in with a plan. You can throw away the plan. But it's like something about coming in with a plan already and you're throwing it out. There's still the kernel of that plan still laid there. Does that make sense? I don't know how to...
Yeah.
It's beautiful the way you put it. It's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. You have to have, at least have some sort of roadmap, but then also be willing to adjust that map altogether, or just throw out the plan and just like, okay, we're going to do something else. But at least you have to have some sort of starting point.
Always. I mean, the way Felipe and I worked on the film, we shot list every single scene. Even when we know we're like, oh, this scene is going to change because, you know, Sam is going to do something that we don't know what the hell he's going to do. and that was Sam. We never know what the hell he's going to do until we call action. You know? But we still shot list every single scene, you know, like every weekend. Like, you know, every weekend we would sit down. We shot it for 5 weeks, right? It was supposed to be planned for 6 weeks, but it came down to 5 weeks. And every weekend we would meet up in a coffee shop and go through each scene. You tell me what you're thinking about and whatnot. And I'm like, you know, I'm thinking about this, da da da. And then, you know, we shot with it. You know, Felipe has a overhead diagram of where A camera, B camera will go, how the blocking will look like. And I tell him, you know, Donwell, you know, Jennifer might do something different because, you know, she will come in asking questions and not feel, you know, Jennifer is very, how I say this, intuitive. She, you know, she's very intuitive and she had to feel everything. So like when we rehearse, you know, like when you see the scene, the lights changes, you know, the monitor, something going on in the monitor. We have to rehearse with every single light cue already in place so she can really feel and be in the scene and really feel it out. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, we already had a plan. Like one time we had a plan of her certain blocking, you know, to one, you know, one big scene. And she said, nah, I don't feel like I should do that. I don't understand why would I do that? You know what I'm saying? And then I had to like, okay, what feels natural to you? What is the issue? And then, you know, then we take, you know, extra 15 minutes just to do another rehearsal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm the exact same way. I shot list everything.
Yeah. And then Felipe will pull his hair because we block, we rehearse and say, this ain't it. And then we had to another rehearsal, re-block it. So the whole crew will come in and look. And then Felipe had to figure out, I tell Felipe, I have no idea where to put the camera. I was like, Felipe, I have no idea. You know, please help me out. And he starts to think and rub his head, you know, ask more questions. And, you know, then he figures it out, you know, and that's, you know, most of the time I handle the cast and to make sure the script is intact. I have Felipe save my life when know where to put the camera. And that's the point. Is the thing about it. And I know I'm taking over a little bit. Here's something that a lot of filmmakers I wish will understand. Your DP is like a marriage on set, man. That's a marriage because your DP got to know I know Felipe for 12 years. He's like a brother to me for 12 years since film school. We met at NYU film school. He worked professionally on almost all my projects except for commercials. Oh, because he was never available. He shot my thesis film for NYU. He shot my first feature film. He shot this film. And this man knows my artistic expression. When I turn around and only work with the actors, I could turn back around, look at him and see where he put the camera, and it's correct to my vision. And you want that. And that, and people say, well, how do I find a DP like that? You know, really meet people, always interview your DP, and then, you know, look at their stuff. Filmmakers, please do not ever hire a DP just because they have their own damn equipment. A lot of, a lot of filmmakers mess that up. Look at their work, rent the equipment. Unfortunately, does it cost money? Of course, but you're not, you can't cheapen yourself by somebody just because they have their own equipment and they don't even know what the hell they're doing. Equipment can always be rented and protected under insurance. So always, always choose a cinematographer that knows what they're doing. They look at the reel. And then when you hire the right person after interviewing them, you have, you and your DP will have to sit down and watch movies together and determine what style, when you watch these movies, what style will really work. Because there are movies that Felipe has an idea that didn't work for a certain amount of projects. There's movies that I sat down and watched with him and that didn't work. I'm not saying I have to watch the entire movie. You know what I'm saying? Like at least 10-20 minutes. Like for example, like for CES, they was, you know, it's going to be independent. We're trying to find a feel to it. And he was watching Pariah from D. Reese. He really thought that style would help. And I was like, hell no. So immediately we understood each other. So, yeah.
Well, I'm curious. So how did you end up at Thunder Road? Because it sounds like they were really one of your first partners. So how did that relationship start?
My first partners was 40 Acres in a Mule Filmworks, Spike Lee. That's my first partners. Thunder Road became like my next family right after 40 Acres because I read the script. Like I told you, I read the script on the Blacklist. They already had the movie. By the time like we figured, my agent was trying to figure out where the script is, they already had the movie. Mm-hmm. And I just had to work my ass off on the pitch. I really had to impress Basil Iwanek in that pitch meeting. And also Will Flynn and Brendan Boyer, who was part of Thunder Road during that time. And I just spent 2 weeks building the deck, you know, writing down my pitch, and then trying to figure out how to make the pitch conversational, because a pitch usually takes about 10 minutes, right? And, you know, and then practice it for, you know, with my team and friends and whatnot, and then pitch it, you know? And then after that, like, you know, he really loved the vision for it. Like, Basil really loved the vision for it. And we just went to work, you know, me and Doug went to work on the script.
So I want to hear a little bit back about your experience getting to your first feature, because you kind of had an amazing story that you made your short film, and then that got turned into the feature version of that short, which is like everyone's dream and everyone's intention coming up with their first short film, but like very few people actually do it. So can you just talk about like the circumstances that led to your short being turned into a feature, like through Netflix for your first feature?
Sure, man. Where do I begin? It took me 5 years. It took me 5 years to make my first feature film. I repeat that. It took me 5 years to make my first feature film. But prior to those 5 years, it took me 5 years of just practicing filmmaking by making short films for NYU Film School. I went to NYU Graduate Film School, which at that time was a 5-year program. And, you know, during that program, I get a lot of short films. And I wanted, just like any filmmaker during NYU, everybody want to graduate with a feature film as their thesis film. Everybody was delusional. I was delusional. I had a second draft of a feature script in March on my I think it was my third year or my fourth year. And I told all my professors that I want to shoot my feature film in July. Delusional.
Ambitious. That's all.
Ambitious. No. Delusional. And the reason why I say that, because I was not ready for that. I wasn't ready for that, because I say this, any short film I did at that time was not going to get me financing for a feature film. And it's not like I was not going after millions of dollars for my first feature film. It was like, you know, probably $800,000. Still a lot of money, you know, because I was going to make a rinky dinky film that I really love about these two kids time traveling in Brooklyn, trying to stop their friend from being killed by a cop. You know, I really was in that, but my professors and Spike said I wasn't ready for that. And the best way for me to be ready is to make a very strong short film that showcases the idea of the film, which is a proof of concept, right? But make that proof of concept its standalone short film. So, and then write the feature for that. And then, you know, take that short film, put it out to film festivals, meet people, agents, producers, financiers, and they'll come up. And if it's successful in the short film circuit, people will come up and ask you, yo, what else you got? So if you like that movie, I got a feature film script, feature script ready to go. You know, so that was the plan. And, you know, I decided to hire my co-writer. Let me go back. I actually hired two friends of mine to be producers of that film, and they were terrible. I fired them. That's and here's another rule I want to tell the filmmakers: do not work with your friends. Do not work with your friends.
Are you guys still friends, or
no?
Oh no!
Oh no!
Damn. Sorry to hear that.
No. They're wasting my motherfucking time. Excuse my language. Another baby's there. Do not hire your friends. No, there's exceptions to the rule. Felipe Verdere is my friend. Why I work with him? Because he is serious and he puts in the work. He doesn't take me for granted. He doesn't take the work for granted. He doesn't, you know, relax and oops, I made a mistake, or oops, I'm not giving 100% because I know I could get away with it because I'm with my friend. Very important. Do not work with your friends unless you know they're going to put in the work 100% as if they're also very professional. So that others must say that. So I fired them. And then I went on to find new producers. And I hired a co-writer to help me, which was Frederica Bailey. Frederica Bailey and I worked our asses on the short film. We shot the short film. It went out to 35 film festivals around the world. The most important for us for that film was American Black Film Festival. Mm-hmm. Because American Black Film Festival features a short film program through HBO, and five films get selected to be in that program. And all those five finalists are guaranteed to have their short film to be streamed on the HBO app during that time and to actually have broadcast on HBO. And that gives that filmmaker and your film merit, right? So we got that. And I won an HBO Film Award and another film festival called Martha's Vineyard African American Film Festival. So that gives it even more merit. And just for people to wondering, like, why would you just, you know, mostly just mention, you know, the Black film festivals? It's because this film and myself will flourish with a certain type of audience that will help, you know, elevate my project and my film and my identity. So if you're queer, there is definitely a lot of queer film festivals. I forgot there was. It's a big queer film festival. I forgot the name of it. But, you know, if you're you know, an Asian filmmaker with the Asian perspective, obviously there are film festivals as that as well. And for me, this is an animated, very Black story. So American Black Film Festival it is. And it helped. But just to wrap it up, a lot of people saw my film in like a lot of film festivals, not only just Black film festivals, but it was like Film Quest was there, Milwaukee Film Festival really loved it. But here's a kicker. I did not get into Sundance. I did not get into Tribeca. I did not get into South by Southwest. I did not get into Cannes. I did not get into all these super uber film festivals. Didn't get to any of those film festivals, my short. But I still had a drive and a success to believe in my film. And obviously, you know, I had, you know, Spike in the map, you know, with me. But even with Spike, it didn't guarantee me getting into Sundance or Slam Dance or whatnot. But when I wrote the first feature script, right, and I shopped it around town, I was able to get a Netflix deal.
Because, that's amazing.
You know, because, you know, not only I worked my ass off on the script, I worked my ass off on the short film based on the previous 5 years I had as a short filmmaker, right? I made a bunch of failures before I did my thesis film that became award winning, right? Worked my ass off all those years. I had made six short films. All of them failed, except for one. All of them failed. They were terrible. But I knew what I wanted to do, and I worked my ass off on that short, which made my thesis short, made me work my ass off my feature, and boom. You know, a lot of what I'm saying is truncated because there's a lot more that goes into it with those 5 years. And it's just like, oh, I had Spike Lee. No, because I had Spike Lee as my producer, I had to make sure I earned him being part of my movie. First of all, I worked for Spike Lee like years with him. I was his personal assistant on Black Klansman. I was his intern at his office. I was his office PA. I was, you know, also his teacher's assistant. So it's not like I just went to Spike's office and asked and chew his ear off. because I'm a film student at NYU. No, I worked my ass off in front of him and for him. And so he believed in me. Once he became my producer, I was like, oh, I got to make sure I earned this right. So me and Frederica really, really worked hard on that short film and really fucking worked hard. Excuse my language. Really worked hard on that feature script.
I don't want to get... Sorry. Go ahead and finish.
No, I don't want to... Just like, you know, I had a lot of people saying, oh, he just had Spike Lee. That's how he was able.
Sure.
No. Because Spike came on, that means I really had to work harder.
Yeah, yeah. You held your feet. You held your own feet to the fire first.
Yeah, I had to. I was scared to death to let him down.
Mm-hmm.
More than I let myself down. I was like, you know, like, yo, Spike is on it. I gotta make sure I come correct.
Mm-hmm. Before we stray too far from it, so your original short that you found such success for, what was, if you can talk about it, what was your budget for that, for See You Tomorrow?
Oh man, See You Yesterday was for the short film, because I was a student at NYU, right? It was 30K.
Okay.
For student, because I had free labor, mostly free labor and free equipment, most free equipment. But if I wasn't a student, it would have blown out of proportion, to be honest with you.
And how did you raise the money for that? So, was that just through crowdfunding, or did you have an investor, or how did you get the 30 to, you know, to combine with the
part of it? Part of it was a failed Kickstarter campaign that only raised like 2K. Another part of it was my mother refinancing her home.
Wow.
Oh my
Thanks,
God.
Thanks, Mom.
Yeah.
What a great mom.
Yeah.
Oh man.
Yeah. She refinanced her home. Another part of it was I gave a production grant through NYU, because I was one of the students who, you know, a thesis grant for students, and he gave me a portion of that. And another small portion of that as well was student loans.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a budget, but then we was tapping into our contingency line. And I decided, like, you know what, let me just take out additional three K of student loans to make sure we able to get to the end.
So I want to dig deep on something you said, because like you're saying that some people were like, oh yeah, he only got his first feature made through Netflix because of Spike Lee, right? But like, can you talk about what that looks like? Because a lot of people will say things like, take the movie out on town and then Netflix bought it or whatever. Can you go into like more details? Like, did you get reps that helped you with that process, or was it just through Spike, or how did it go?
It was mostly through Spike, because, you know, it was mostly through Spike, but I had to fly out to LA a bunch of times and meet with different studios. And I had to pitch to like five different studios during that time, just because it was Spike. That got me into the door. But then I had to pitch. And then, you know, a lot of people just, you know, questioning, well, why can't just Spike just do this? As if I'm not in the room. I had an executive say, oh, Spike, how come you're not directing this? Thankfully, Spike said, that's the director over there. But I would like almost every time in the room, it was like, yo, if I'm Spike, how come you just can't do it? I was like, I'm standing right in the motherfucking did.
And so he came with you on all those pitches?
Yeah, he's a producer, of course.
Okay, that's awesome. I mean, I don't know. I wouldn't assume anything necessarily.
You
know,
no, I hear you. No, I hear you. No, Spike was like really hands-on when it comes to getting it done. You know what I'm saying? And, you know, I was in the room. He was in the room when we pitched. But, you know, we had to go to Netflix. We had to like go back-to-back Netflix twice, you know, to get it done, right? And then once Netflix said, okay, let's do it, but we need to do rewrites. Me and Frederica, we wrote our script for 6 months before it became greenlit. And we was dead. Man, Frederica and I was dead broke. We was writing.
Oh man. Yeah, I can only imagine. Especially if you had your mom had to refinance your house to get your short made. I can imagine there's no money. I have to hear about what a pitch is like with Spike Lee. Like, how did you guys structure your pitches? What materials did you bring, if any? Like, can you just walk us through how they would go when you would pitch with Spike?
Well, it was just me pitching mostly. Spike would just sit there and allow me to do my thing.
Amazing.
And essentially, like, luckily they already saw my film. Every pitch is different. So it's not like this pitch is a lot different than the way I pitch for other films. Like, for example, with Breathe, had to do a presentation because obviously there's no short film to it. And I had to walk, and I had to, with my presentation, I had to go step by step on how, you know, the reason for the script changes, how I see the vision, and then who the characters are. But for See Yesterday, it was like, they already saw the short film. I just had to pitch the story almost beat by beat on, which is already written, and, you know, on how I see the movie. And then, you know, how I plan to shoot the film. And who are some of the actors I would bring in to, you know, to bring it to help, you know, elevate the publicity of it all, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, you know, it's not a straightforward answer. It's more of like, you know, I can't, I mean, honestly, years ago, I can't remember exactly how I did it, but it was just like, you know, my moment beat by beat.
Now, you're existing in a world that very few filmmakers get to, especially at such an early stage of their career. Because, I mean, so how was it like working with Netflix and then immediately following that with Warner Brothers? I mean, did you feel that you had enough leeway artistically, or did you feel really beholden to, like, listen, we gotta, like, these guys are putting in serious money. Like, are you still being heard as an artist?
Netflix was very supportive. I mean, we bumped heads a lot. I'm like, I think I'll lie to you. It was very supportive, but there were times I felt as if they were doing me a favor more than like they really believed in the movie until they saw the film. Mm-hmm. That's how I felt sometimes when I was doing my first feature film, because Spike was in it. Like, okay, let's, Spike is doing this. He believes in the kid. And this, you know, I'm not saying anybody on Netflix. Netflix has always changed, so I'm not saying everybody on the time that felt that way, but, you know. But even though the success of that, I was very, very blessed when, you know, Thunder Road, it wasn't, so not Warner Brothers, it was Thunder Road that came and allowed my vision for it. And luck, you know, it was just like, it was mostly, you know, my vision that was unique and different, and it felt fresh for them. That was like, this guy has a really cool idea. Mm-hmm. You know, even though he's still green, we really love his idea and we love his passion for it. You know, thankfully, he already had a first feature film. So even though he's still green, he really has that experience and he has a freshness to it. Let's take our chance with him. And I think that's very important. It was really hard to get my second feature off the ground, man. I'm not gonna lie to you, because it's like everybody's saying, can this guy pull it off? Mm-hmm. That's what it is. That's what it is. Because I'm not proven. Like, you know, it's like, you want to give, you know, somebody that's no name with X million dollars to do this. Same thing with Netflix. You really give somebody who never experienced X millions of dollars to do this, you know, and, you know, I appreciate it and I'm grateful. And, you know, it's not until you allow people to fail upwards, then you see the result, you know, that's the best thing I can say.
Well, yeah, but I mean, you must have had some clout coming into your second feature after your first one was on Netflix and it was produced by Spike Lee and, you know, all this stuff. Like, that's got to count for something, right? Like, I imagine if you hadn't had that, you know, if your feature was a smaller budget first feature that didn't premiere on Netflix, maybe the conversation would be different, you know?
I mean, yeah, perhaps, yes. I mean, I would never been through the door if I didn't have the first feature film done, to be honest with you. Never. So yes, that did help. But if I didn't have it, then nah, it would have worked. Not for Brie. You know, because there were, you know, Thunderbolt is, you know, they're working on a certain caliber of filmmaking. And I had to prove myself that I can reach there.
I wanted to go back a little bit and I wanted to talk about your film festival experience, because that, I feel like, is something that filmmakers struggle with a lot of times. You know, you've got your short or you've got your feature. You send it off to 150 different film festivals. You're waiting to hear back from everybody. And then you end up going to these places and with the hopes that, like, you're going to network, you're going to find that next producer, you're going to find the financier. And a lot of times you come up goose egg, man, you got nothing. And yeah. So what was your experience like? Because it sounded like it was extremely positive, and it sounded like you found quite a few people when you were on that circuit.
Yeah, I was blessed, you know what I'm saying, because people really love my short. There was some producers had to push away because Spike was already on it. So, like, it worked. Like, the plan did work. Like, there was some producers coming at me like, yo, I can give you $2 million. I could do this. I could do that. I'm gonna rep you. And I was like, I already got a producer. So like, to let you know that, you know, there were people coming at me, it still worked. What people need to remember is to always make sure you're working on the first script. Make sure you're working on that feature script. Just don't, you know, enjoy the festival too much. Don't be too comfortable. Make sure you're working on that script. When was that ABFF? You know, Spike, we went to, me and Fajika went to Spike's hotel room. He sat down, he was giving us notes. So it wasn't all just like, you know, we there just to, you know, click champagne with the other filmmakers. It was working. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, always have something else to pitch.
Always, yes, always have something to pitch.
So now that you have two features under your belt, you know, and one's a $50 million movie, and I imagine the Netflix one was probably like in the low millions or something, you know?
I have to say, I'm extremely blessed and privileged more than a lot of filmmakers are. Not a lot of filmmakers can't say they have two feature films. So I do recognize that, to be honest with you. And I also
especially at the
recognize that a lot of my peers.
Yeah.
I know, especially at the budgets I have. It's phenomenal. And I have to say, like, there are filmmakers that I know, my peers that went to NYU that I know who deserves it just as much as I do or more. And I just, and to for the sake of God, and I don't understand why a lot of producers and executives in this industry is not giving these people the chance to do so. It kills me. And I don't want to hear anything about the pandemic or the strike. Fuck that. It's like my man Court Jefferson said during his Oscar speech, you got to give the new young folks a chance. Yeah. Can't we just be doing all these franchise movies? What happens to the mid low level films? These is important. This is important. How are you going to expect for this industry and art to grow if we're only using the same people, the same kind of storytelling, the same thing? We're being stagnant. We're not growing. There are a lot of people who have fresh ideas. And I don't know about you. I'm getting tired of this damn superheroes movies. I'm getting tired of it.
Yeah.
How many Star Wars movies how many Star Wars shows I have to watch? Ahsoka was great, but damn.
many Jedi more. Out.
Yeah. All right, we're gonna go into our final six. These are kind of rapid fire questions. So just go ahead and answer them as best you can for whatever you think the answer should be. Number one, what was the first film that you ever made and how do you feel about it now? And this can be a student film you made in high school. This could be something based on a book report. This could be something you made in the backyard with your friends. Whatever you consider your first film.
My first film was at Morehouse College. It's now a really, really big producer, Stephen Love, who just did The Claude Tyrone. He was classmates at Morehouse College. Yeah, he was classmates at Morehouse College, and we did it. Yeah, yeah. Great movie. The Claude Tyrone is a great movie. We did a movie at Morehouse College. I forgot the name of the movie. Called Saved. It was called Saved. And it's about this kid. It was for Campus Movie Fest. And it was about him to save a Spelman knight from committing suicide. And I was like, Spelman knight is a woman. It's a young lady that goes to Spelman College. It's our sister school. And it was like a black and white 5-minute short film that got to, I think, the semi-region finals at Campus Movie Fest. So, you know, it was like, wow. It was like a Ricky Dinky camera. We had those little small camcorders and we just shot the movie, you know, that way. We edited on a little laptops. It was crazy. You know, thinking about it now, I was like, wow.
Paying your dues.
Like, yeah.
Yeah, 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 yeah. We don't know what the hell we was doing. I remember we was in an apartment, somebody's apartment, and we burned a carpet with one of the lights.
Oh, shit.
Before the LEDs,
I was freaking out. Yeah, before the LEDs. It was bad, you know. It was like, oh, my Lord. Yeah, it was fun.
What's the best filmmaking advice you have ever received?
Don't fuck up. That was from Spike.
And the converse to that, what is the worst filmmaking advice that you've ever received?
When your movie is released, you have nothing to worry about. You'll find the next project. That's the worst.
Who told you that? Don't.
A lot of people. A lot of people did. Don't ever listen to them. You're going to have to work your ass off in every single project you're trying to chase after. And nothing's going to come easy. That's the worst advice. I cannot believe I took it.
Well, you didn't take it for long because you got your second feature already done. So, do you have a goal as a filmmaker?
Oh, yeah, I do, man. I have an amazing feature film that I'm working on with Lord Levin of Beatrice Levin. It's like a black Indiana Jones.
Oh.
It's set in Ethiopia about a gunslinger teaming up with an Ethiopian princess to stop fascist Italians from raising an ancient monster from the dead called Cthulhu.
Oh. You got my money. Let's go make a movie.
I'm in. Opening weekend.
Yeah, I'll be there.
Oh, yeah. So that's where we're working on that. I'm doing that set at the beginning of the segment. We are attaching actors now to go back out to studio.
All right. Good luck, man. Good luck.
Thank you.
If you could go back in time and give yourself a piece of advice, what would you tell young Stefan?
Make sure you save your money and get it. And get a financial advisor, a good one. Because when you become a filmmaker, I'm blessed to where I am right now, right? But when you become a filmmaker, 10% agent, another 10% manager, 0.5% your lawyer, publicist, taxes, plus debt.
Wow. And paying your mom back for refinancing that house. Yeah, absolutely.
Paying your mom back. you know, if you be careful, be careful with your finances. That's what I would teach myself. That's the only thing I will ever go back in time.
Yeah. That's a good one.
Because they don't teach you, like, when you're an artist, they really don't teach about financing. They don't. They never do. Because when you see the big check, you'd be like, damn, this is a lot of money. And then, you have a different mentality on that. And, you know, I hurt myself doing that too many times. Mm-hmm.
Last question. Is making movies hard?
Yes. And yes, 100%. Not in the sense of, like, you know, like just doing it. It's more of like, there's so many, making movies hard because of a couple of things. Number one, the politics of it all, right? Obviously. But for me, is my ego gets in the fucking way. Not a lot of people teach you about your own ego until you experience it. Emotional intelligence is so important. The amount of times I let my ego in the way, I've hurt people, which I've apologized so many times to those I know I hurt. I think I know everything, and I damage good friendships, good relationships, good ideas, good collaborations. Because, you know, and I come from a place where, like, I never experienced it before. Like, this is so foreign to me. I grew up in Brooklyn. I grew up in Coney Island, Brooklyn. Everybody knows about Coney Island in the 90s and early 2000s. It doesn't seem like you're going to live past your 20s. Imagine that in my mentality, coming into, like, yo, I get to do this. Oh, my ego's into the motherfucking roof. And I allow my ego to get in the way because I don't know. I just don't know. So that's, you know, talking about the filmmaker of itself and the politics, sure. The ego can, you know, if you don't know how to maintain your own ego, that's going to hurt you. And you're going to hurt others.
That's great.
Amazing.
Okay, so final thing. How does our audience help support you? How do they support Breathe? Stefan Bristol, we want to help. How can we do it?
Go to the theaters, April 26th, the theater near you. If it's not in the theater, on demand. Showtime. Watch the film.
So, Liz, the one thing that really stuck out from my talk with Stefan was what he had said about, I'd asked him, like, what did he learn from this, making this movie, that he took on to the next thing. And it was a really interesting answer that I was not expecting. He basically said something to the effect that, like, working with the actors, like, he had to readjust, like, his expectations and how he approaches actors from his first feature to his second feature. Because he was working with, like, big names like Jennifer Hudson and, oh gosh, what's her name? From Resident Evil.
Mila.
Yeah.
Mila Jonovich.
Yeah. And then, like, you know, just talking about how each actor had their different way that they like to be directed, and they love different way they like to interact with the process of creating the movie. And, like, he was very much like, you know, this is the way that I see it. Like, this is the way that I want to do it. Like, you're here, you're here, you're here. He said that one of the actors, I can't remember which actor it was, but one of them was like, hey, look, dude, like, you just need to, like, don't tell us what exactly to do. Like, you have to just tell us what you're seeing for the story, like, what's happening with these characters. And then we will help you figure out what makes sense. Like, don't try to take it all on like that. You're not going to do our job for us. Like, you need to, oh, it was Common.
Oh, Common. Like,
you need to just, like, just tell us what you're looking for, and then we'll all figure it out together. Like, don't tell us exactly what to do. Like, that's just not how this works. You know, Sam Worthington's the other one who was in the movie. And it was just, like, it was really fascinating to hear Stefan talk about, like, all these different, like, big names that we all know, and, like, how he learned that he had to adjust his style, you know, of directing. Like, that what worked on his first feature with, like, a lot of kids, I think, in his first movie, does not really work when you're dealing with, like, you know, big time actors who are, like, you know, do this all the time, you know? So yeah, it was a really, really interesting conversation. Man, I can't wait to see what Stefan does next. I feel like his career is, like, exploded, you know? It's funny hearing from him. He's like, yeah, it took me so long to make my second feature. I was like, bro, like, you made it in, like, 4 years. Like, come on, man. He was like, it took me 6 years to make my first feature. I was like, yeah, all right. It took me 8 to make my first feature. So no, time is good. It's not a big deal. You know, no rush, you know? Anyways, yeah, but Liz, I think it's time for... Yeah.
It's time for You're the Expert?
I think so.
Okay, that's what I'm calling it, because I just listened to us debate about that in an episode a few weeks ago. It's time for our segment, You're the Expert. These are actually, we've been summarizing it poorly. I kind of, in a self-deprecating way, have been summarizing this pretty poorly for a while now. But these are either questions from our producer or from listeners and their questions with regard to indie film production, that we would have something, you know, an expert opinion to weigh in on. So this week, the question is, hey, all, I got distribution for my first indie feature. I want to get the word out, so naturally I'll be posting on social media. But what are some other methods of publicity that I could pursue? So, Ulrich, what do you think?
Well, yeah, social media is obviously a good thing, but I would make sure that working with a team, I think, is really important for this. Like, don't just do it yourself, because like you might be able to get the word out and do a lot of great work, but like working with a PR firm is going to like really boost your ability to reach people. And I think like the more people you have promoting your movie, the better your movie will be promoted. So if you hire a PR team that has a team that's going to work with you for a short amount of time to promote your movie, that is what's going to help it reach more people. So I would like enlist other people on your production to help with the promotion. Don't make it just your job only, like ask other people to take this on and help you. But yeah, I would do a PR firm. I would make it a group effort outside of social media. I don't know, man. I feel like people have talked about billboards. People have talked about getting ad space, like, you know, on TV or whatever, but I don't even know, man. I don't know how much that really makes a big difference. It's I think it's hard to quantify. I feel like with social media, you can actually see on Facebook, like who you're reaching and how many people you've hit and like the clicks that you're getting for your ads. And I feel like those metrics are really helpful. I've heard Reddit is really good too. Like, I think people should be utilizing Reddit more, because I think mm-hmm. you can really reach a lot of people. And there's a lot of niche fan base people on Reddit. And like, if you have a certain type of movie, like I think you can really find that audience on Reddit in addition to other places. So I wouldn't lean away from social media. I would lean into social media, but I should just figure out ways that you can utilize it better and then bring a team and bring PR people to help you. But Liz, I think you're more of the expert on this question than I am. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, like, I'm a big fan of publicists. I think you have to have a goal in working with a publicist, because very easily you could say, hey, can I retain you? And then they'll give you a pretty generic outreach breakdown that involves pitching podcasts like ours. And I mean, like, you could also just email us directly without your publicist. So it's like, what is the publicist providing to you that you can't access yourself? Unless you don't have time to be your own outreach coordinator or be your own publicist or write these pitch letters. I mean, with my second feature, without my publicist, I could never have gotten in Entertainment Weekly, which was a very, very, very big deal for me. It did not convert sales, but I think there are other goals you may have with regard to publicity that don't have anything to do with sales, but have to do with your own profile as an artist and like what kind of attention you want to receive and from whom. I really believe in digital marketing and digital marketing managers and digital strategists. Like, I think they're incredibly important. I just think many people get to distribution and they can't afford a digital marketing manager, let alone the ad spend. So it's tough, right? So if you have resources, like if you only had a small amount of money, I actually would still encourage people to use it for digital ads on Facebook and Google and Twitter. I won't call it X. It's fine. Whatever. Because I do think there is a world where you're just trying to get eyeballs, and those are the places where eyeballs are.
Hear, hear.
Hear, hear. But what do you think, dear listener? Let us know. You can send us a question, comment, or suggestion to podcast@makingmoviesishard.com. If you like the show, you can leave a review on iTunes. Check us out on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter at MMIH Podcast, YouTube at Making Movies is Hard Podcast. Thanks to Stefan Bristol for coming on the show. Thanks to Sam Anaya from Katrina One PR for setting this up. Our editor, Jeff Reimuth, for doing the editing. To Robert California Jones for handling all of our social media. And thanks to our producer, Eric Toms, for being awesome. Thanks to all of you for listening, and talk to y'all next week.
Have a good one.
Have a good one. Bye.
And the baby is gorgeous, by the way. You're telling
me. Thanks.
It's a cute baby.